All right, let's go ahead and open up to the book of John. The last couple weeks, we were looking at the Samaritans, and someone had asked for some maps, so I thought we'd throw that in at the beginning here. I've got three maps set up. This is the divided kingdom of Israel. Now, in the days of David and Solomon, the kingdom reached the nation reached its farthest extent. After the reign of Solomon, the nation split. And that's where we're coming to here with the Samaritan woman. She's from Samaria, that northern kingdom. And the nation of Israel split off into Judah, which includes Jerusalem and also included Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin. And then the other 10 tribes were the northern kingdom of Israel. And they were up in here. And here's Samaria. So that's the someone had asked, which direction is it up to Galilee? Samaria is north of Judea. And when the nation split in two into that southern kingdom and northern kingdom, this is what it looked like at that time. This would have been, let's say 950 BC when it first split. Jeroboam left Jerusalem, came up to Samaria, and built and introduced this new new religious system, an idolatrous system. He put calves at the farthest extent of his area. He put a calf worship in Bethel, and he put calf worship up in Dan, kind of encircling this whole area. The capital is Samaria, but sometimes the whole region is called Samaria, especially after the captivities. And so with that in mind, let's look at what it looks like with the 12 tribes, because remember, the Samaritans, we pointed out earlier, are especially associated with the tribe of Manasseh. That's Joseph's son. Remember, Joseph had double the portion. He had two sons, so a portion went to each son. Ephraim and Manasseh, and the Samaritans associate especially with Manasseh as when we get to the Assyrian captivity. But this is kind of a map of where those tribes were. You have Judah, Simeon, Benjamin here, you have Manasseh, and all these other tribes up in the north. And they're going to form that northern kingdom. Judah and Benjamin form that southern kingdom. And that's the tribes of Israel. But here's probably the important one for our study with the Samaritans is Manasseh. And we'll reiterate that as we go through here. Then here's the days of Jesus now. You can just superimpose this. Here's Jerusalem and Jerusalem. And then as you go, here's Galilee. So as you go north from Jerusalem, you can kind of follow the line. You go through Samaria and up into the Galilee region. And sometimes if they didn't want to go through Samaria, they could go over here and go up the east side of that area and kind of go around Samaria. Sometimes even going over the Jordan River and coming up here and then going into Galilee. So that gives you an idea of where we're at when Jesus says in John 4, he says he left Judea. Here's Judea down here. And he's going to Galilee. And he's going to pass through Samaria. And it says he must needs pass through Samaria. And it's important to realize that this Samaria area has been under a lot of different rulers. It's been under, it was the northern kingdom under Israel's rulership. And then it was went into Assyrian captivity, Babylonian captivity. They came under Greek rule. They came under rule of the Judeans, which is really the main reason for the split in John 4. That is brought up in John 4 between the Jews in Judea and the Samaritans. And of course, after that, they come under Roman rule like the rest of Israel. So that's a little bit of that background history. And we talked about when that nation split, let's say about 950 BC, you had the land was full, and you go to the Assyrian captivity, that about 200 plus years. During that time, you had idolatrous Israelites in the land of Samaria. They went up to the north. That's Israelites who followed Jeroboam, those 10 tribes who followed Jeroboam into his idolatry. And those were carried off, those idolatrous Israelites, Samaritans, Samarians, because they live in Samaria, were carried off, leaving the land barren as far as the idolatrous system. And then Assyria sent Gentiles, idolatrous Gentiles, into the land. They took over the pillars and the altars and the high places that the idolatrous Israelites left behind when they were taken captive, and they just picked up their religious system there. And then you fast forward another two or three hundred years, and then at that point you finally have the Samaritans of John 4 coming on the scene. They build a temple here in Samaria at Mount Gerizim, and they become a group called the Samaritans. The point is, the Samaritans you read about in 2 Kings 17 aren't the same Samaritans as you read about in John 4, and we covered that quite a bit last time. One thing that people really, is a little bit surprising to people, is that in these captivities, we kind of read the account in the Bible, and it says they took the people away. Well, that doesn't mean they took all the people away. If we have, we actually have numbers. We don't have such explicit numbers for the Assyrian captivity, but we do for the Babylonian captivity. In 2 Kings, there's a record of the number of Israelites who were taken captive by Babylon. And there's also a set of numbers in Jeremiah. And when you put those two together, in the Babylonian captivity, based on those numbers and estimates of the population in Judea at that time, less than 25% of the nation was actually taken captive. Less than 25% of the population was actually carried off to Babylon. 75% stayed in the land. But what they did is they took away the leaders. They took away the craftsmen that kept that idolatrous system go. They took away the businesses and the leaders and the people with special talents, you know, like Daniel, who had leadership talents and was literate and all that, all those, and they was young, and they would go be taken off, but 75% of the people were left in the land. And the same thing can be said about Samaria. When it says this northern kingdom, the people were carried off, it doesn't mean all the people were carried off. Even if we, in the Babylonian, it said less than 25% were actually carried off. But the ones that were carried off are the important ones, the elite, the business leaders, the craftsmen, the one with skills and talent, and so they're all removed. So it destroys the nation. Because the people that established it and made it work are now gone. And if you assume the same thing in Samaria, let's say 50% were carried off, you still have 50% left in the land. It's going to be the poor and the weak, the elderly, the ones who didn't have special talents, weren't literate, weren't able to contribute anything, and the Gentile nation they were going to, they'd leave them behind. And what the Samaritan history is they identify themselves with those people left behind, especially those from the tribe of Manasseh. And there you have, these would be a part of that believing remnant of Israel, especially from the tribe of Manasseh, who remained loyal to the Lord, who refused to participate in Jeroboam's and all the kings since him in that idolatrous worship, the calf worship and all that. They remained loyal to the law. They were rejected from society, as the believing remnant always is rejected by the overall idolatrous nation of Israel. You can read almost open to any prophet and read about that. And they're persecuted. They're not so much poor because they don't have talents or things. They're poor because they're persecuted. Jesus talked about them in the Sermon on the Mount, those who are poor. He talked about the poor in the Sermon on the Mount, but he wasn't just talking about the poor in general. He was talking about the poor who were poor because they were persecuted for righteousness' sakes. They were part of the believing remnant of Israel. And so you had left behind here the poor and the weak, and part of the poor and the weak would be part of that believing remnant of Israel. And they believed that Manasseh was especially faithful to the one true Lord and had less participation in Jeroboam's idolatry. They were left behind because they were poor, because they were persecuted, left behind in the land. And that's actually the basis for the future Samaritans that would come on the scene, who would be loyal to the Lord, who remained faithful and loyal to the Lord, albeit worshiping on the wrong mountain, but otherwise loyal to the Lord. They thought they were devoted to the law of Moses. They came up with their own Pentateuch, the Samaritan Pentateuch. And all this is after 400 BC. That's when the Samaritans of John 4 really come on the scene. They're not the Israelite Samaritans or Sumerians that were carried off in the Assyrian captivity. They're the Samaritans who were left behind. The Samaritans that were carried off are gone, absorbed into the Gentile world, and the Israelites who remained faithful to the Lord, part of that believing remnant of Israel, stayed in Samaria, and ultimately, hundreds of years later, become the Samaritans of John 4. And that's where we are in John 4. So it's important, I think, to realize that people are especially surprised that when it talks about the people being carried off, we generally think that everybody's carried off, every single person. But that's not the case. A large portion is left in the land, but a large portion that can't really run a nation. They've taken away all the craftsmen and the people's skills and talents. All right. So the Samaritans of Jesus' day considered themselves Israelites, especially being descendants of Jacob and Joseph, especially of the tribe of Manasseh, which we just talked about, who survived the Assyrian conquest and deportation in or from the land. The main distinction they made was that Mount Gerizim was the right place of worship rather than Jerusalem. That's actually going to come up in our account here, so it's a good thing to have in our thinking. They were dedicated to the law of Moses and were waiting for Messiah. And we're going to see all those things in here too. They considered themselves a sect of Judaism, and this is supported by Philip's ministry in Samaria in Acts 8. You remember Philip, because of the persecution in Jerusalem under Saul, our Apostle Paul, because Jerusalem persisted in rejecting Christ, or is that persecution? And remember from our map, if you get pushed out of Jerusalem, where do you go? Into Samaria. That's north of Judea there. And they got pushed in Samaria, and he's preaching to the people in Samaria, Samaritans, and they're identified in Acts 11:19. We won't turn there now because I think we did this at the end last week. They're identified as Jews in Acts 11:19. Acts 11:19 said, all the people scattered because of the persecution who were preaching, they only preached to the Jews only. So there we have, if Philip was preaching to the Samaritans at that time, they were considered Jews, and that's not too far after. And it's Jews in the broadest sense. John, in our Gospel of John, Jews usually refers to Judeans. It's the absolute sense of the word. Not Jews like the world thinks of Jews, just as anyone from the nation of Israel, the kind of the broader sense. In John, it's the Jews, specifically the Judeans, and specifically the religious leaders in Jerusalem. When you get into Acts and he goes out, they're considered Jews. Now, obviously, they're not in Judea. They're considered Jews in the broad sense of that word, as being part of the nation of Israel. All right. And I thought it was worthwhile. I actually have an article here that talks, because of genetic testing recently, it talks about the Samaritans, and they've been able to test their genetics to see if they're really Israelites. because that's what they claim, that's what they think, that they come go all the way back to that partial believing remnant that was left in the land of Israel at the Assyrian captivity, who remained faithful to the Lord, especially as members of the tribe of Manasseh. And some people have actually done some genetic testing, and I'll just read this article from a few years ago. I'm just going to give a couple excerpts. Samaritans who trace their roots back 2,700 years, that's the Assyrian captivity, are best known for clinging to strict biblical traditions that have largely disappeared, including animal sacrifice, isolation, and until a ban on, I think this is an important one, I guess I don't have this article on any slide, a ban on marrying outsiders. Now, that goes all the way back. The traditional way of viewing the Samaritans is they're kind of this half-breed thing, basically a little more than idolatrous Gentiles. And that's not the Samaritans of John 4. The article goes on to say, Samaritans are one of the oldest religious sects, similar in practice and beliefs and ancestry to Jews. They follow strictly the Hebrew Torah, but instead of Jerusalem, they revere a temple their ancestors built, what is now the West Bank, on a hillside in Mount Gerizim. Mentioned several times in the Bible, Samaritans also are considered one of the most inbred communities of the world. 46% marrying first cousins and more than 80% marrying blood relatives, according to research by Israeli geneticist Bathsheba Bon-Tamar, who spent her career studying this community. And then just one last thing. Samaritans have long been the focus of genetic research, initially because of their ancient roots. Samaritans claim that they are descendants of the northern Israelite tribes that were conquered by the Assyrians. Subsequent genetic testings shows that the Samaritan men carry the so-called Cohen gene, which links them directly to the ancient Israelites. What they claim, what they think is true, is true. They are Israelites, they are Jews, they're a Jewish sect, and they adhere closely to the Torah, the five books of Moses. They revere the patriarchs. We're going to see that today. And they're waiting, at least in these days of the Samaritan woman, they're waiting for Messiah, the Christ, to come. Now, Jesus must needs go through Samaria to complete the picture. Why must he needs? This is a common literary technique of John's. He uses this must needs. Remember, it said in John 3, it talked about Moses lifting up the serpent, and then it says, so too must needs, must the Son of Man be lifted up. So too here, the Son of Man isn't going through Samaria just because it's the quickest route. That's the way most people would go through. And that's another aspect of the traditional teaching. They say that no Jew would go through Samaria, go all the way over the Jordan and around it. He'd do whatever he could to go around it. But that they're finding out that's not true. They would be just like you or me. They would go the quickest route possible, and that was usually through Samaria. And that will also play a little role in our account here of the Samaritan woman. So he must needs. Why must he needs? Well, it's not just to go the fastest route. What he's doing here in the first four chapters of John is he's giving a picture, a movie clip of a foretaste of Israel's national salvation. He's been to Jerusalem, he's been to Judea, he's been to Galilee, he's been all those places, but now he's got to go to Samaria because Samaria is the last location. And the way God's prophetic program with Israel works is first Jerusalem has to receive Christ. Then Jerusalem goes to Judea and Galilee and they receive Christ. And then Judea and Galilee go to Samaria and rejoin with their brethren in Samaria, show them the errors of the way, their way, and Samaria joins with them to worship God and Christ in Jerusalem. And when that happens, all Israel will be saved, And once all Israel is saved, she'll be restored and be made into the greatest nation on earth. And with her and through her, salvation will go out to all the rest of the world. That's the way it works in God's prophetic program with Israel, that he's under this hour, this Daniel's time schedule, their prophetic clock. We read about this again in John 2, where Jesus told his mother, "My hour has not yet come." And here we're going to start hearing about this hour again. He's got this hour that was delineated in Daniel's time schedule. Sir Robert Anderson and others say they can figure it out to the exact day, if not the exact hour, that he's going to be on that cross. It leads to that final Passion Week and to his cutting off on the cross. And so he's going through here. He must needs go to Samaria because that will complete the picture of Israel's national salvation. With all this history in mind and all this background we just quickly talked about, we went in much more detail last week, so I'm not going to go in any more detail now. But with all this history in mind, we know what the woman is thinking. We know what her inner thoughts are. What I'm going to ask is that all the things you know about this Samaritan woman, all the traditional teaching on it, just kind of set it aside. You don't have to throw it away. If you want to go back to it, go back to it, but just set it aside for a second because we're going to look at some things about this Samaritan woman, it's going to be a little different than the traditional teaching on this. And we're going to keep all this history in mind we just did. Now we've done the background on the Samaritans in general. Now let's look at, we looked at who the Samaritans are in general. Now let's look at who the Samaritan woman is in specific. And we know we can have a hint. If we know this history, we know what her deepest desires and longings are. Jesus does too, and he's going to fulfill them in this account. Again, this isn't going to be the traditional account of this passage. I'm going to try and make this woman into a real person and with real desires, real hopes, real longings as she comes down and meets the one who can fulfill them all at this well. And once a professor gave me some of the best advice I ever had, I had to write a term paper and I couldn't think of anything to write about. And he said something I use all the time now. He said, as soon as something is such common knowledge, everyone just assumes it's true, that's the time to start looking at it and check it out. When everybody stopped thinking about it because everyone thinks they know that it's what's true about it, that's the time to start writing an interesting term paper on it. So that's what I'm going to do today. And we'll take a look at, we can determine who this Samaritan woman is. And let's just see if there's some other options besides the traditional view. One of the problems with the traditional view is because most people who teach John don't understand where it falls in the Bible, don't understand where it falls in God's plan and purpose, don't understand that it's not for today in the dispensation of grace. It's not an evangelism book for evangelism. It's serving a specific purpose for that believing remnant of Israel as they go now and fulfill God's prophetic program with the nation of Israel. It's not an evangelistic tool. So what happens is teachers try to turn it into an evangelistic tool in the dispensation of grace, and they kind of come out with a warped picture of this poor woman, as they do with many other sections. So let's just look at her coming at noon idea. Now, what does traditional teaching usually say? It says that she's a woman of ill repute. She's kind of slinking through the countryside when all the other women are in the house, you know, taking care of the kids. All the reputable good women are in the house taking care of the kids or cooking lunch or whatever. And she's slinking through the countryside, sneaking down to the well because she can't go there at the early time. when all the good women go, because she's excluded from their society, because she's a woman of ill repute. All she's thinking about is her next conquest and illicit conquest. And that's kind of the picture you get from most teaching on this. And I'm going to suggest something different. I'm going to look at it a little bit different. But there it could be just as well when it comes to the coming at noon. There's a lot of other reasons she could be coming at noon for water. There's nothing in this account that demands she's been outcast by the villagers, by her fellow Samaritans, and has to sneak down to the well when no one else is there, especially women. There's nothing in the account that indicates that. There's all kinds of other reasons that she could be going to that well later. She could have gone there earlier, loaded up, and then had visitors that morning and used up all the water. And she's coming back to get some more water. Could be she ran out. Could be she had visitors. It could be, here's the one I think, it could be that like Jesus, maybe she was on a journey. And before she went home, she's going to stop at the well and get some water, just like Jesus stopping at the well. Let's read that in verse 7. Let's pick it up at verse 7. Well, let's pick it up verse 6, because that's where we get the noon hour. Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied with his journey, sat thus on the well. So he's weary, he's thirsty. Maybe she was on a journey and she's coming to the well because she's weary and thirsty. And it was about the sixth hour, so it's noon in Jewish reckoning. There cometh a woman of Samaria to draw water. And Jesus said unto me, her, give me to drink. For his disciples had gone away to the city. So she may just be coming for a whole different reason. To read and hear this whole thing about her being an outcast and a woman of ill repute and all this, and the other women won't associate with her. See, that's just reading a bunch of stuff into the text that isn't there. And what I think is another thing that could be going on here, if you remember, one of the main themes of the Gospel of John is the light metaphor. Go back to chapter 1, verse 7. The same came for a witness, talking about John the Baptist, the same came for a witness to bear witness of the light, that all men through him might believe. He was not that light, but he was sent to bear witness of that light. That was the light which lighteth every man that cometh into the world. You have this light concept, and at the noon is the height of the light of the day. She's coming at the height of the light of the day to the light of the world, the Lord Jesus. I think it's also possible that this coming to the brightness of the noonday light plays with John's metaphor that describes Jesus as the light, and that those who come to the light, and that's one of the main things we just read in look over at chapter 3, verse 21. Who are the people that come to the light? Verse 21, but he that doeth truth cometh to the light. Now, you know, that's what Nicodemus did. Flip back to chapter 2 and look at verse 2. The same came to Jesus by night and said unto him. So here you have Nicodemus coming out of the light, coming out of the darkness of the night and entering into the light of Jesus. The Samaritan woman, you have the Samaritan woman that's coming into the light of the noonday sun to meet the light of the world. I don't know. To me, I think that the more important significance of this noon meeting isn't this bunch of read-in stuff about the character of the woman, but about this light metaphor Jesus is bringing in. Nicodemus came to the light. This woman is coming to the light. And I think that has an important rule to play here. Verses 8 and 9 now. So I think that's why she's coming. I don't think we have to read in all the ill repute and question her character and all that kind of stuff. And now let's read some more of this account. and let's go step by step. So that kind of deals with verses 6 and 7 and the noonday thing and drawing, coming to the well. Then saith the woman of Samaria unto him, how is it that thou, being a Jew, askest drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. And so there you have, in verses 8 and 9, you have another thing. Most commentators say the traditional way this is taught is the end of chapter 9, where it says, for the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. Commentators just kind of willy-nilly assume that's not the Samaritan woman talking. That's John, and kind of an aside, the author John, kind of explaining something, kind of giving an aside here. But you see, that misses the point of this whole passage, really, because that's impossible, because what it misses is John's use of irony, which he does over and over again in the book of John. It misses the whole Johannine irony. If you want an example of that, you can look at John 19:19, where you have Caiaphas, and he talks about Jesus being the king of the Jews. He's mocking him, but the irony is he's stating a truth. And John uses irony all the time. And here's the irony that's in these verses. This is the woman still talking. She's come to this well, and here she's saying the Jews don't have any dealings with the Samaritans. And that's so blatantly, in the context, not true. Just look back at chapter 4, verse 4. And he must needs go to Samaria. So here you have a big group of Jewish men. It says just as disciples. I suppose there could be some women in there, but I guess it's probably mostly men. And they're going up, and they're going to go into Samaria. And guess what they're going to have to do when they go through Samaria? They're going to have dealings with the Samaritans. The Samaritans. Then you have a group of disciples. Let's look at that, verse 8, just the verse before this. In verse 8, you have, for his disciples were gone away unto the city to buy meat. Here you have a group of Jewish disciples going to a Samaritan city to carry out dealings with the Samaritans for food. And here at the well, you have a Jewish man dealing with a Samaritan woman. This whole passage, the whole context, is full of Jews interacting and dealing with Samaritans. And that's the irony. She comes along, she's just babbling. She's doing like what we do when we're around the water cooler or at a park waiting to use the fountain. We just talk kind of nonsense as we're waiting with the people around us to talk. She's just talking nonsense. She's just talking like we would talk when we're waiting in a line to get a drink at a fountain in a park or something, or water cooler. It's proverbial, hasn't it become, with standing around the water cooler, shooting the breeze. And she's just talking, because what she said blatantly, the irony is here, she says this, and John has already shown in this account that the Jews have all kinds of dealings with the Samaritans. And he gives all kinds of examples as you go through. Is this irony? This is supposed to make us smile. And realize there's something beneath the surface here that John is trying to get at. So let's see what's beneath the surface here. What we see is that the stereotype of Samaritans isn't really the reality, the true reality with the Samaritans. She comes into this noonday sun, and she's thinking, we can know what she's thinking on the inside. Remember, that's what we've set up this pattern going all the way back, especially the highlights were Nathaniel, Jesus' mother, Nicodemus, and now the Samaritan woman. Jesus, they come along and they're just babbling something, just like this woman is doing. And they're just kind of babbling something. And when they're done, he just sweeps it all aside and throws it away. And he starts going down he plunges down into the depths of their soul. Well, if we remember the history and the context that we're in here, we know what's in the depths of this Samaritan woman's soul. We know what's in her thinking. We know what she's thinking about. If we stick with the contents and not make up something for evangelistic purposes to sound like this is a bad woman and Jesus encounters a bad woman, so he'll encounter and save us too. This isn't evangelism. He's going to plunge down into the core of her soul and he's going to address her deepest longings. And so when we think of that, we can know what she's thinking. Just look at this passage. Now that we know the history of the Samaritans as a whole, in general, we know something about the geography of this area. We're going to read a little about that. We can know what she's thinking about. We don't have to make up. We don't have to put words in her mouth or in her heart, our mind. And just let's look at some of the things here. Then cometh he to the city of Samaria, which is in Sychar, near to the parcel of ground Jacob go. This is verse 5. Near to the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Look at all the history in that. You got Joseph, which you also have Manasseh, because he's the son that this gets passed on to. You have Jacob. If you have Jacob and Joseph and Manasseh, you have Abraham. It all starts piling up. And here she is coming. And she talks about, she's thinking about Jacob's well. Look at verse 12. Art thou greater than our father Jacob? She considers her father Jacob to be her father. And Jacob is the father of Joseph, and Joseph's the father of Manasseh, and the group of them together are her father. She reveres the patriarchs. That's what the Samaritans, they revere the patriarchs, the same patriarchs. Notice she says our fathers. She's including the Jews' fathers as well. These go to the Jews in Judea as well. She's got all this history here. Look down, and then that's going to bring up some of this worship concept. And sure enough, verse 20, our fathers worshiped in this mountain. It's going to bring out this worshiping. But look at verse 25. The woman said unto him, I know that Messiah come, and who is called Christ, and when he comes, he shall tell us all things. And the us there could just be the Samaritans, or it could be the Jews and the Samaritans as they come together to form that united nation. So the point is this, we know what she's probably thinking about. We don't have to put illicit thoughts in her head or make her really bad character. We know based on the history of the Samaritans, based on the geography, based on what she actually says. She comes in the new daylight to Jesus, thinking inside that this is her father Jacob's well. And that's going to bring to mind, the father Jacob is going to bring to mind Joseph. Joseph's bones are buried right down the street from this well. I forget, I think it was a few hundred yards from this well in Shechem the bones of Joseph. So this is the history in this area. She comes out into the full light, to the light of the world, and comes to her father Jacob's well, and to the place that's just a little hop, skip, and a jump from where Joseph's bones are buried. And when she thinks about Joseph, she thinks about Joseph's son Manasseh, which they think particularly was one of the important tribes that made up that Samaritan group, not necessarily exclusively, but one of the more important ones. And that comes to mind. And when you put all those together, you know what she's going to think about next? That reminds her of Abraham. And guess in Genesis 12 where the first place Abraham worshipped in the land? Shechem, which is just a hop, skip, and a jump from this well. It's in the same place as this well. Abraham worshipped here. Jacob's well is here. Joseph's bones are just down the street. Manasseh is an especially important tribe that the Samaritans came out of. And she's got all this in her head. And can't you just see that wells up in her, this well of worship? And she begins to think about worship. And she asks Jesus about this worship. And then to top it all off with all that in place, she says in verse 25, I'm waiting for Messiah. I'm waiting for the Christ who will come and tell us all things. And of course, we know there you get some more irony, right? She says, I'm waiting for the Christ to come who will tell me all things. And Jesus in verse 25 or 26 is going to say, he's here. I am. The Lord Jehovah God of Israel is here. The Messiah, the Christ, is here. And he can give you all things. To me, that's a better picture of this poor Samaritan woman than the ones usually generated to make it kind of an evangelistic account. Here, let's give her a little respect and realize this could very well be what she's talking about, because she actually talks about it in the passage. She talks about Jacob's well. She talks about worship. She talks about Christ and Messiah. She talks about all those things, and all those things can come together. We know what she's thinking about. We know what's in her heart, her longing. She's longing in her heart and the depths of her soul for a Christ, a Messiah, to come and tell her all things. She doesn't know all things yet. She's waiting for him to come and tell her all things. Isn't that true of us too? We're waiting. Of course, we have God's complete revelation, and now we can just go there. But she's waiting for Christ to come. And the irony is that he's there right in front of her, and that's what he's going to reveal to her. So that's in verse 8 and 9. And when she comes in verse 8 and 9, and she's talking about this stuff, you know, Jews don't have any dealings with it. She's just doing water cooler talk. We know what's going on inside her head and her heart. That's what's in point A here. But on the outside, just like with Mary on the outside, with Nathaniel on the outside, what good thing can come out of Nazareth? Nicodemus on the outside, how can these things be? Blah, blah. You are such a great guy. See, all that just gets swept away, and that's what he's going to do in the next verse. She comes just babbling this stuff. What she's saying obviously isn't true, because John has just presented a whole group of Jews who are having dealings with the Samaritans. And she's just blabbering, and the context proves that. It's like talking at a fountain in a park or water cooler talking. She's just talking like we would talk to a bunch of strangers around the water cooler. But this is all just a setup for Jesus. Like Nathaniel and Mary and Nicodemus, Jesus is just going to sweep all that away. He's just going to take all that external, superficial blabber, and he's going to sweep it aside, and he's going to plunge into the depths of her soul. He's going to sweep aside the water cooler talk, and he's going to go to her deepest desires and longings, the things that are most important to her, the things we just listed out here as she goes to that well and thinks about Jacob and Joseph and Manasseh and Abraham. Abraham worshipped here. He built an altar and worshipped here, Genesis 12, 6 and 8. That her patriarchs were there, and she's waiting for Messiah, the Christ. That's her on the inside. That stuff about how the Jews don't have any dealings with the Samaritans, that's all just external blabber. And the irony of John putting it here drives that point home as we go through this passage. So we don't want to write that section off. This is all just a setup. He's going to plunge to the depths of her soul, where he's going to sweep aside all that she's thinking and go to the deepest desires and longings that lay unsatisfied in the pit of her soul, in the bottom of her soul. He's going to plunge down there, and he's just going to land in this stagnant, dead water that's not satisfied her, that's not given her what she's needed, that's not told her all things. And he's going to go there, this dead, stagnant water that's just sloshing around in there. He's going to offer her lasting satisfaction. He's going to offer her living water, something that the patriarchs alone or together couldn't do. Look at verse 10. Let's read Jesus now. So she's just said this. She's just blabbering. We know what she's thinking on the inside. If we follow along this line of logic here, we know what she's thinking on the inside. We know she's thinking about Jacob and Joseph and Abraham and Manasseh. And she's thinking about worship of God. Abraham worshiped God here. Her deepest heartfelt desires, the longings of her heart is Messiah, waiting for Messiah, the Christ to come and explain all things to them. That's what she's thinking on the inside. That's what's in her heart. On the outside, she's blabbering. Oh, you don't have a cup. How can you get water out of the thing? How do you, the Jews don't have dealings with Samaritans, all that. And now Jesus is going to just sweep all the external stuff aside, and he's going to address this stuff. What's in her heart? What's in her thinking? Sweep aside all the water cooler talk. And he's going to do that. Verse 10. Jesus answered and said unto her, if thou knewest the gift of God and who it is that saith to thee, give me to drink. I think we should stop there and look, what is this gift of God? Remember from John 3:16? I guess we don't even have to probably turn there, right? For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. Oh, it's the gift of God. It's the gift of his Son. And he's come now through the incarnation to offer grace and mercy to Israel first, to save Israel first. And he's now here in Samaria. He's been to Jerusalem, Galilee, Judea, and now he's in Samaria. And he says, if you'd known who it was that is talking to you, give me to drink, thou wouldest have asked of him. This is John 4:10. We're back there. Him, and he would have given thee living water, not like the stagnant dead water in the pit of her soul. He's going to fill her up with a well of living water. Verse 11. So now the woman is going to banter a little bit more, babble a little more, only there's a little more substance to what she's babbling this time. She's going to keep increasing in substance and less in babble as we go through this account. The woman saith unto him, sir, thou hast nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. So you got a little banter there, a little babble. From whence will you draw this living water? Now there's the question. She does get to a substantial question. Where are you going to get this living water? And she says, art thou greater than our father Jacob? So now you know what she's thinking about. You don't have to go by what traditional teaching says. She tells you what she's thinking about. She's thinking about her father Jacob and his well, and then everything, all the patriarchs and everything associated with that, which gave us the well and drank thereof himself and his children and his cattle. This is Jacob's well, and it met all Jacob's needs. Why can't it be enough for us? Why isn't it enough for our needs? And Jesus is going to answer in verse 13. He's going to show that he is greater than Jacob and his well. Verse 13, Jesus answered and said unto her, whosoever drinketh of this water shall thirst again. But whosoever, this water, Jacob's well, can only quench thirst temporarily. But Jesus' water, verse 14, but whosoever drink of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst, but the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life. The water Jacob could offer her quenched temporarily. The water Jesus can give quenches permanently. Jacob's water represented the things that can't permanently satisfy. Jesus' well of living water will provide everlasting fulfillment of all her most longed-for needs and desires. And we know what those needs and desires are because we know what she's thinking. We know what's in her heart. We know what she's waiting and longing for. We know that she's got this in her thinking, in her inner person. She's got all this. And he just sweeps aside the babble and goes into the inner person. I can supply what you're looking for. I'm the fulfillment of everything those patriarchs look forward to. I can provide you, Jacob could provide you with physical water that quench your thirst for short periods of time. I can give you living spiritual water that will quench your thirst forever. And he's the one who can offer that to her. Jesus is greater than Jacob and Israel, Jacob slash Israel and his well. We're not going to turn back to all the whole history account here. Genesis 48:22. You can go back and read the account when Jacob received, how Jacob gets this parcel of land. When Israel came out of Egypt, they brought Joseph's bones with them and buried them in the land Jacob bought for 100 pieces of silver from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem. Now, if you remember from our map, it's on the map in the beginning. I won't go back there. Shechem is just a stone's throw away from Sychar, where they are at this well. You see the tie-in? She goes to Jacob's well, and that would remind her of Joseph's bones down the street. And it reminds her this is the place Abraham worshipped when he first entered the land. And all this thing is going on, and she's waiting for Messiah. Sychar is about 1 mile from Shechem. Joseph's tomb is just a few hundred yards northwest of Jacob's well. And you can read where Abraham worshipped here in Genesis 12:6-8 here. We go with this, and Abraham worshiped there. I guess let's look at the Abraham one, just so we see, get a good idea of this. Genesis 12, God just reiterates that Abrahamic promises. It's not a covenant yet. That won't be till Genesis 15, but he makes promises to him. And look at verse 4. I guess let's pick it up at verse 2. Genesis 12, verse 2. And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse them that curse thee. And in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. That's the promise to Abraham. That's the grace resident in the Abrahamic covenant. I will bless those who bless you, and curse those that curse you. Another way of putting it is, I will save my friends and destroy my enemies. Abraham's and God's enemies and Israel's enemies. That's the basis of the Abrahamic covenant. You see, that's not what God's doing today. Every traditional teaching says we're under the Abrahamic covenant today. That's just a bunch of nonsense. There's not enough grace in the Abrahamic covenant for what he's doing today in the dispensation of grace. Today in the dispensation of grace, he's not saving his friends and destroying his enemies. He's saving his enemies, blessing his enemies, because he has no friends. It's a totally different program. And for that, you need the riches of grace that's revealed in Pauline Grace Mystery Truth. Verse 4, so Abraham departed as the Lord had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old, and he departed from Haran. And Abraham took Sarai his wife, and Lot his brother, and all the substance that they had gathered, and the souls that they had gotten in Haran, and they went forth into the land of Canaan. And into the land of Canaan they came, and Abram passed through the land unto the place of Shechem. Here it's Sychem in our King James, but that's Shechem. That's the same place as Shechem, under the plain of Moreh. The Canaanite was in the land at that time. And the Lord appeared to Abraham, verse 7, and said, unto thy seed will I give this land. And there builded he, Abraham, an altar unto the Lord who appeared unto him. And that's where this woman is. This is where Jesus is, this general area, not that exact spot. But within a few hundred yards, all of this is going on. And I'd suggest that's what this woman is coming down to this well. This is what she's thinking. She comes at the high point, the high light point of the day, to come to the light of the world, the Lord Jesus Christ, who happens to be at the well too. And she's coming thinking about Jacob's well. She's going to get from Jacob's well what all of Jacob's family thousands of years before got from this well. and she's going to get a drink. It's going to quench her thirst temporarily, and that's going to remind her of Joseph, Jacob's son, and the Jacob passing on the blessing onto Jacob's two sons, Manasseh, one of the key tribes for the Samaritans, and she's going to think about Abraham worshiping at the spot when he first came into the land, and all these things are going through her head and what she's thinking about, generating worship and going to the longing for Messiah and the Christ to tell her all things. And that's why Jesus must come here. The northern area, that Samaria area, is waiting for the Lord, waiting for Christ. Yes, they're messed up in where to worship, and they're messed up in details. They've thrown away the part of the Old Testament, a good part of the Old Testament. But when we keep in mind, you realize that most of historic Christianity has thrown away most of the Bible, too. They've thrown it away. They call it spiritualizing away. And they spiritualize away Israel. Israel really isn't Israel. It's us, the body of Christ. The curses aren't the curses. The blessings are for us. The curses are for Israel. That's called spiritualizing. That's what the bulk of historic Christianity does. Through spiritualizing, they throw away most of the Bible. So yet you can have believers even who throw away, spiritualize away most of the Bible. Well, that's what these Samaritans did. They got rid of the parts they didn't like, the parts that said Jerusalem was the place of worship, and they kept the parts they did like, the five books of the book of Moses. So we don't have to gasp in awe. All the same things that the errors that Israel make is the same thing that historic Christianity makes. It's just a little bit different context. So let's just close by appreciating the Samaritan woman. Now, if we go from that standpoint, I think the rest of this account is really going to open up. But let's just look at the progress. There's a progression here as we go through this passage. Notice in verse 4, he says he must needs go through Samaria. So there's this must needs concept, and I talked earlier today, that will bring his little foretaste picture, movie clip, video clip of what it's going to look like when the nation of Israel as a whole gets saved. And it begins with Jerusalem, Judea, Galilee, and Samaria, and then out to the rest of the world. So there's this progression. It's going to begin with Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria. Galilee, then go out to Samaria. Notice in chapter 4, verse 22, ye worship, ye know not what. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. There you have especially the Jews and the Judean. It begins in Jerusalem and Judea, goes to Galilee, and goes to Samaria. It begins with the Jews, the Judeans, and springs out from then to the rest of Israel and the rest of the world. Then it's going to close. We see that in verse 42, chapter 4, verse 42. And said the woman, now remember the woman's going to go and tell the people in the city about Christ. And they now come to Christ, they listen, and they believe. Verse 42, and said unto the woman, now we believe, not because of thy saying, for we have heard him ourselves and know that he is indeed the Christ. Remember, that's what they're looking for, they're waiting for. That's what she said she's waiting for, the Savior of the world. So you have this progression. When he must needs go to Samaria, he's closing off this picture. He's finishing off the salvation of the nation of Israel. He's been to Jerusalem, Judea, Galilee. He's taken care of the Judeans associated with the Judeans who ruled Galilee. The Judeans are part of Jerusalem. And now he's going to the Samaritans in Samaria. So that the whole nation, a picture of the whole nation being saved. And then once Samaria is saved and the whole nation is saved, then salvation can go out to the world. And you have a little mini picture of what it's going to look like at Christ's return when he's going to usher salvation into the world. It's going to begin with Jerusalem, Judea, Galilee, and then go out to Samaria. Then all Israel will be saved. She'll be planted in the land, restored as a nation, and be increased to become the greatest of all nations. And with Israel and through her rise, salvation is going to go out to the whole Gentile world. And we just need to point out at this point, that is not what God is doing today. That program has been set on hold. Now what God's doing today in the dispensation of grace and his mystery program for the body of Christ, he's sending out his salvation apart from Israel and through her fall. Totally different program, totally different avenue. Now he's sending out his salvation through the revelation of Christ that he gave to our Apostle Paul.